I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Millions of animals are used in research every year. Cosmetics, pesticides, pharmaceuticals, half of every dollar we spend on products is for something that was tested on animals. Animal rights advocates condemn animal testing, but many scientists say it is vital. Can technology solve this problem? Dr. Thomas Hartung, director of the Johns Hopkins University Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing, believes it can go a long way. His own lab at the Bloomberg School of Public Health has just developed a tiny replica of the brain using human skin cells. This mini brain could replace hundreds of thousands of animals now used in neurology labs. Alternatives to Animal Testing. That's Midday, right after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for joining us. Today we're talking about the use of animals in research and the search for alternatives. Think about heart transplants, the polio vaccine, penicillin. All these discoveries relied on animal research. In fact, the vast majority of all the Nobel Prizes awarded in physiology or medicine honored discoveries that depended on animals. Animals are also used in testing products for safety and in education, but it can be gruesome for the animals. In 2014, the U.S. Department of Agriculture reports more than 72,000 animals suffered pain during experiments without being given anesthesia for relief. And that doesn't include the most commonly used lab animals. The law does not require labs to count mice and rats. There have always been people who question the morality of animal testing, but until recently, there have not been many viable alternatives. That may be changing. With us to explain is Dr. Thomas Hartung. He directs the Johns Hopkins University Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing. Dr. Hartung is also the lead researcher of a new discovery, a miniature model of a brain cultured from human skin cells. These mini brains, or something like them, could one day replace drug testing on lab animals in neurology labs. Welcome to Midday, Dr. Hartung.
Hello, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this new product you're developing. Journalists call it a mini brain, but is it a complete brain?
No, it's not a complete brain. It is as big as a fly eye, so it's really tiny, but it has structures which are the key structures of a brain. It has all of the different cell types. They are interconnected. You know, brain cells are communicating. They're exchanging signals, chemical signals and electrical signals, and that's exactly what this brain is able of doing. So we can study some very fundamental things you normally can only study in a full brain, which means in an organism.
So there's the same kind of electrical activity
yes.
going on in this tiny little thing, the size of a fly eye, the same kind that goes on in a human brain?
Let's say from a molecular side, yes. A human brain, however, has input. So we have eyes, we have ears. These mini brains are just cell balls. They have no input. They have nothing to reflect on. They have also nothing, no way to express themselves. It's just the early circuitry which is forming, which means they are showing some of the fundamental reactions you want to modify, for example, in some diseases by drugs.
So this is about drug testing primarily?
I see the biggest use for this model in drug testing. I mean, you have to imagine, we have Alzheimer, we have stroke, we have multiple sclerosis. There's tons of diseases which affect the brain, and a large part of drug research is in this area, and literally using hundreds of thousands of animals every year.
So you culture these balls of brain cells from human skin cells.
Yes, that's the fundamental technology, which was exactly 10 years ago only invented, that you can produce cells which are like embryonic cells from the skin of a donor. And it got the Nobel Prize in 2012 already, one of the fastest Nobel Prizes ever, because it is really making a difference. You don't need any embryos. You can use skin donated voluntarily by a patient or by a healthy donor. And you can then start producing any tissue. You can produce hearts, livers. We produce brains. And this is really opening up for a bright future of work without animals.
So when you talk about creating one of your many brains that you could use, for example, to test something related to Alzheimer's or something related to Parkinson's disease, would those original skin cells be from somebody with that disease, or is that an element that you would introduce into your mini brain as you are turning it into a mini brain?
This is exactly the fantastic opportunity we have. You have to understand many diseases depend on a genetic component. We are not the same. My risk of developing, let's say, Parkinson is different to yours. Mm-hmm. And if I take already the genetic makeup of a person who has developed Parkinson, I know that this was obviously a person at risk. And I can combine in my research now these possibly more sensitive brains with the factors like pesticides or others which we suspect to produce Parkinson disease. So, but I can also use a healthy disease, a healthy brain, and simply ask, what is hitting everybody?
So what? Tell me more about how this might be used.
I mean, the first thing is we want to enable the massive testing of substances, be it for safety. For example, in the US, we have likely about 60,000 chemicals in consumer products. And the large majority, we're talking about more than 80%, have never been tested. So we have a lot of information gaps on the safety of chemicals in everyday products. And one of the reasons is it's simply too expensive to test this on animals. If I want to know whether a chemical is producing cancer, it does cost $1 million and I will have the result in 4 years. That's what the animal experiment is.
And is most of that million for the animal, the animals, their care and feeding and the analysis of, I mean, how much does that cost of searching out whether a particular substance is carcinogenic? How much does that go down if you don't test in animals?
Oh, the animals itself is not really the point. A rat, laboratory rat, is about $20 to $30. Maintaining it, a stabularium for 2.5 years, its lifetime, that's costly. You need personnel, but still the big money goes into evaluating all of the different tissues in this case. Really studying, do you find cancer in any of the organs? And this is a lot of work for highly skilled professionals. But when using a cellular system, you're dealing with tiny, tiny little things. You don't need a stabularium. You can put, literally on the space of your hand, you can put hundreds or thousands of these cellular models, and you can study with modern technologies in these mini setups.
And are there, we've been talking about your discovery announced just last month about a mini brain. Are there other mini fake organisms that can be used in testing? Are they on the way?
That's actually at the moment really stimulated very much by the availability of this new type of cells, these stem cells which come from skin cells. Mm-hmm. There's a mushrooming of these models. You can argue that the brain is the most complex one. And actually, the very first of these models has already been described exactly 2 years ago. There's two or three others who have produced mini brains over the last few years. The breakthrough for our research was mainly that we were able to mass produce them in a very standardized way. And this makes really a difference, that we can produce literally thousands of these brains, which all are exactly the same. Because if you want to find a new drug, you want to test hundreds of different possible candidates. And this is only possible if you can test all the time on the same brain. Like you use all the time the same animal. We use actually identical twins. They're all the same age, the same weight. They're genetically the same, because only then we can compare the effect of a possible drug. And that's the same for these models. And the mini brains, which we have seen before coming out of Austria, but also out of Stanford, for example, they were more or less individuals. Each of them tiny, nice little brain substitute, but they looked different. So it's
and
really
yours, and yours will be identical.
Yeah, this is the big thing, because that's what pharma research, what toxicity testing does require: the easy availability of identical brains.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Dr. Thomas Hartung. He's director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing. He and his colleagues have developed a mini brain that could replace animals in some lab testing. Has your life been changed by a medical advance developed through animal testing? How do you feel about that? Send us an email at midday@wipr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. That's our local number, 410-662-8780. We also have a toll-free number anywhere in the state. You can call 1-866-661-9309. You mentioned a minute ago that part of the big expense of testing the carcinogeneity of a chemical through an animal is analyzing the effect on a lot of different organs. So for this to be a replacement, to turn into a replacement for much animal testing, you're going to need many brains and many hearts and many lungs, and you're going to need a lot of organs to stand in for mammals, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what is happening. This is the exciting developments. Our mini brain was developed with funding from NIH and FDA, and they are developing and sponsoring at the moment the development of humans on chip. So this is a combination of 10 such organs on a chip, which are combined with, we call this microfluidic, which means there's a type of bloodstream between these organs.
Yeah, that's what your mini brain doesn't have. A circulatory system.
No,
right?
It does not. That's why it's one of the reasons why our mini brain can't be bigger than a fly eye, because we don't get enough oxygen and nutrient into the center of such a mini brain.
And it also limits the life of your mini brains, right?
No, we can maintain them. We have no indication that we cannot maintain them longer, because we just keep them at this size. But the combination with other organs is now very promising. I mean, there's drugs which are only activated in the liver and then reaching the brain. Or there could be a blood-brain barrier, which does hinder substance to actually reach the brain in the organism. And we would get false results if we don't have also a blood-brain barrier in our model.
How did you get into this line of work? Why does it interest you?
I mean, I was, first of all, I was a pharmacologist. I mean, I think this is something which is very important to me. I'm a researcher, I'm a physician in the School of Public Health. We are not about animal welfare. We are about better public health. We are about saving people, finding treatments. But we simply believe that animal testing very often is a technology of the last century and of the beginning of the last century, literally. So it's extremely important to understand that we are driven by making science better. A lot of these essays which we are talking about have been designed before I was born, and I'm now 52. Yeah? Science has developed in this time, and we want to set this into motion. So as a pharmacologist and toxicologist, I learned more and more the limitations of these animal experiments. They don't give us the results we need. Let's stay with the example of cancer, which I used before. 32 ingredients of coffee have been tested in rats. 1 million at the piece testing these. Yeah? 23 of them were carcinogenic. They produced cancer in these animals. Is coffee for this reason the brew of carcinogens? Should we fear drinking it? No, not at all. There's no evidence that this is a problem in humans. And this holds true for many other things. Aspirin would not make it to the market today. It's producing embryonic malformations in almost every animal species, but not in humans. And it is really making our science more human relevant by moving to better models.
We need to take a break here. Obviously, there is lots more to talk about. We're going to Dr. Thomas Hartung, director of Johns Hopkins Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing, will be here with us. He is also the Bloomberg School's Dorenkamp Zbinden Endowed Chair in Evidence-Based Toxicology, and you just heard him describing the importance of evidence in all this. Join our conversation. Do you make a point of buying products that do not rely on animal testing, or do you think lab testing on animals is no more troubling than eating meat? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Dr. Thomas Harting, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing. He's also the endowed Bloomberg School of Public Health's Dorenkamp Zbinden Endowed Chair in Evidence-Based Toxicology. Polling from a few years ago showed that more than half of respondents in the U.S., 56%, were okay with animal testing, but that was down about 10 points from a decade earlier. What do you think? Join this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I want to pick up where we were, and I don't want to, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but it sounds to me as if you were saying your particular interest in this is not so much from an ethical or moral concern about testing on sentient beings, but whether or not it is the best science, the most efficient way to learn how medical advances and drugs will affect humans.
The beauty of my job is that I have both. I have the ethics behind me, and I'm convinced that I'm moving the ethical argument by concentrating on the science, which is much more convincing for many of my colleagues.
And it is hard for a non-scientist like me to get past the idea of assuming that testing on a mammal, especially when we talk about testing on something like a monkey or a chimpanzee who seems to look a lot like us, that that would be the gold standard in figuring out how stuff is going to react in our bodies.
Yeah, but we're simply not 150-pound rats or 250-pound rats. There's strong differences. Even with monkeys, we have had cases where things which were completely safe at 500 times higher doses in monkeys, when first tested in men, brought 6 people into intense care treatment within hours. These type of things happen. The animal is simply an approximation. It is only a substitute for testing on humans. Sometimes it's the only way. Then we have to do the best of at least carrying out these experiments as humanely as possible, using painkillers, anesthesia, and others. But at the same time, there is enormous technological breakthroughs, like our mini brain, allowing us to do things which were impossible some 10 years ago.
So that you think, just as you don't have to make a choice between the efficacy of research and the ethics of it, you think that we don't have to make that choice in the lab?
That's exactly the point. We have to make it a win-win-win situation. And there's a lot of reasons. Ethics is one. As you said, about half of the population does not accept animal testing as easily. And if you think about testing on your dog, you would probably get quite concerned. But there's also, beside this moral argument, it's a matter of time and costs. It does cost us about $20 million to establish the safety of one pesticide. If you would like to have the same safety for all of your products, imagine multiplying all of the products with $20 million, just for safety testing. That's not doable. At the same time, you want to be sure that whatever you buy in the supermarket is safe. So we need to find ways of doing this faster, doing it cheaper, mass testing things. And this is possible on tiny little cell cultures. And this is possible if you use latest computer technologies, for example.
Yeah, tell me, how do computer technologies play into this?
We have more and more the opportunity to produce massive databases. For example, we announced last month the creation of the largest database on safety on chemicals in the world. Database.
My eyes are, I just realized this about myself. I hear the phrase database and my eyes start to glaze over. Tell me why this is powerful in in looking for alternatives to animal testing.
You have to imagine we made a database of 10,000 chemicals with 800,000 animal experiments. So this is billions of dollars which went into this research. We made this computer readable. So what we can do now is we can produce a type of map, a map where the chemicals which are very similar are grouped very close to each other, and those which are further away are different in structure and in functions. And then you can start looking, where are the problem substances? Where are those which are producing skin allergy, those which are producing eye irritation? And you see that they're cluster. There's certain clouds of substances where these are very frequent, and there's clouds where you have nothing. There's no problem at all. And now you have a substance which has not been tested. You have no data. You can place this substance into the map, and you can ask, what is surrounding? Is this a surrounding of danger? Is this a surrounding of, or is it a surrounding which is clean, harmless? It is not perfect. You can always have a surprise, but it is perhaps 80%, 90% perfect. It's much better to evaluate the untested substances this way than not to evaluate them at all, which we cannot afford.
So this toxicity map that you're describing is based on decades and decades and decades of animal experiments.
Yes.
So you're piggybacking on that. But you're saying you think you can avoid needing to do more animal experiments going forward by capitalizing on what was learned from animal experiments already done.
We have to use what we have, which is the legacy data, the history. And here we are mainly thinking of industrial chemicals, where it's better to have some information than none. But if you're looking for new drugs, you have to produce new data. And in drugs, you have to be so certain, if you're moving into systematically treating the first humans, that you need data. And here it is about using things which complement the animal, which make us pick better substances and reduce drastically the number of animals we are using at all. And that's where things like the mini brain come into place.
And it's been a long time since I took organic chemistry, but it's possible the organic structure and signatures of these chemicals make it absolutely clear where they would go on this toxicity map. I mean, is there a danger that you look at a chemical one way and you put it in the northwest quadrant, and then all of a sudden you find out, no, it actually could have been put over here, and we would have read it completely differently in terms of the warning it would have given us.
These methods are not perfect, but they are better than nothing. And if you see the difference between a human and a rat, for example, this is also not perfect. So we live in an imperfect world, but it is a very, very simple and easy to get piece of information. Something which raises flags, which you then can control. Imagine all of the hundreds of substances which are in one product or in the supply chain of producing something. There are so many substances involved. Nobody can start sorting them out and going meticulously into each of the substances. So you need something to prioritize. And that's where these tools are extremely helpful.
Yeah, one of the things you told our producer, Andrea Appleton, is that mice and rats predict each other only about 60% of the time.
Yeah, isn't it crazy?
Because I can't tell them apart. So, I mean...
And that's exactly the point. And there's no reason to assume that a rat would predict humans better than they predict mice. And this is one of the key arguments we are using, why we need humanized test systems. That's why sometimes even a tiny little cell wall of human cells can help us can be better even than an entire rat or mouse, which is completely misleading.
Yeah, that is a hard thought to get around. That's Dr. Thomas Harding here on Midday on WYPR. He is director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing. Half of what we spend on products is something tested on animals. Are you surprised to hear how common animal testing is? Join this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Your unit, the Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing, is supported by a number of large corporations that undoubtedly do a lot of animal testing, Procter & Gamble, Clorox, Exxon. So how badly do the industries themselves want to move away from animal testing? And if they do, why?
Well, they have many reasons. they have, first of all, a public relation problem. There's too much of the of consumers who don't want products associated with animal tests if this is not necessary. But they also have a problem that they need information fast. They need to get information on a lot of substances at reasonable cost, and animals do not provide this. I use the example of the cancer assay. Everybody would like to be sure that...
I'm going to interrupt because you're using a word that scientists use, but we don't often, and that is assay.
Okay. An assay is a test. It's a way of testing a property of a substance.
Okay.
So, good you interrupt me. The cancer assay is a good... the cancer test is a good example. As I said, it takes 4 years and $1 million to get the information whether one chemical is a carcinogen. And then we cannot trust it. I gave the coffee example. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really about giving these companies tools to very quickly decide, this is a substance I can put into a product and I'm not endangering a customer. Nobody wants to poison their customers. And that's why they are working very closely with us. But we obtain our money also from public funds. We are funded by NIH and FDA for our research. But the biggest resource actually is philanthropy. We depend very largely on some individuals who are supporting us and with really big sums of money, but even tiny amounts which we get from school classes and others to make our work possible.
So in other words, you get business and corporate support who are interested in more efficient and trustworthy scientific results, and individual donations of people who are troubled by the ethics of animal testing.
Yeah. No, in the end, everybody wins. When we can show that an alternative method is replacing an animal, animal welfare wins, the industry wins because it's cheaper, faster, possibly even more predictive, and science wins because a modern method has replaced an old one.
So we've talked about your mini balls of cells, your mini brains. We've talked about toxicity mapping and essentially using computers to suck more information, more understanding out of animal testing that's already been done. What other kinds of alternatives to animal testing are you looking at?
These are actually the most important technologies, and I'm giving here two examples. One is cell culture, especially cell culture based on human cells. And this has to be done really one organ after the other. And we're seeing fantastic progress. The skin models were the first. We're having in the labs now for about 15, 20 years very, very good skin models. You can produce from a tiny, tiny piece of skin. Square feet of skin are grown by about 5 companies worldwide. And you can order next week, I would like to have 100 pieces of skin. And you can determine whether it should be male, whether it should be pigmented or not pigmented, and so you can really have this available.
And so this is human skin.
Human skin.
And so you would argue, I mean, because I think that's a big part of animal testing, is it not, about skin sensitivity, daubing chemicals on animal skin to see if they rash breaks out and stuff. So you're saying it would be better just to test that stretch of human skin that you ordered from a lab to know how this product will react on a human skin.
And exactly this has happened. So these were the forerunners of making use of human tissues, and it has become a business. So these companies make good money. But at the same time, we have shown and internationally agreed on, it's no longer necessary to test on rabbit skins, which has been only replaced about 5 years ago. And I was very proud. Part of my job when I was working for the European Commission was to run exactly these validation studies where we showed skin irritation can be done as well on human skin created in the lab as in the rabbit. So this is one of the big successes of alternative methods.
What fields use animal testing most? What kinds of labs are most dependent on animals?
That's very interesting. We have seen that animal testing has gone down dramatically from the 70s, when it was mainly done in pharmaceutical companies. So they literally tested 10,000 chemicals before they found one which went into humans. And their test was mainly testing one animal after the other. And this has gone dramatically down. Nowadays, pharmaceutical industry is only using about 20% of all animals. The biggest use of animals at the moment is actually in research, in academic research. The universities, they are the big consumers of animals.
Why are academic laboratories using more animals if commercial laboratories like pharmaceutical labs are using less?
On the one hand, that's a good question. You could argue that pharmaceutical industry is ahead of the curve because they're driven by latest technologies, high efficient. They have all the money in the world. They can use
yeah,
whatever.
They do.
Is, yeah, and that means also they put their money on best technologies. Us in academia, we very often have to use the low tech, the things which are available, because we cannot jump on the next train and use something new. But there's also one technology which has really boosted the use of animals in universities, and this is that we are able to change the genes of a mouse, nowadays also of a rat, that we can produce genetic defects and study what is the consequence if a certain piece of our genome is being changed. These genetically modified animals, or knockout mice, as they often are called, they have led to dramatic increases in the use of animals in academia.
So, with your perspective on looking for ways, alternatives to animal testing, how do you look at that kind of research, that kind of genetic research? What do you see would make it feasible not to use animals who have been genetically modified?
I mean, first of all, it's a wonderful technology. It has given a lot of scientific publications and insights, but it's still a mouse. It's not a human. And we can do the very same thing with our mini brain, for example. We also here use cells where a certain gene has been changed, has been knocked out, has been taken out, and we can study in a system which we can do in thousands of replicates. We can study what the effect of this is.
Okay, so I'm just like sitting here taking on faith, going back to the idea that this mini brain is the size of the eye of a fly, and yet you can operate on it and change it and affect its genes.
Yeah, but we start with the cells from which we grow the mini brain. So these are molecular techniques which are just the same which you would use when you're manipulating an embryo to produce these mice. You use the very same technologies to change a cell and then grow the mini brain. But here you can study the brain in isolation. You can do lots of experiments. You're always limited in number if you're dealing with animals. And you have to imagine to bring the animal to 3 months of age before you do the experiment. This gene has led to a lot of compensatory mechanisms. This mouse is not the same. In order to survive these 3 months with the genetic defect, it has had a lot of problems often. And our mini brains are just one organ you can look at. And that's why these technologies might help us also to reduce, in basic research, over time, the reliance on the respective animal model.
We have to take another short break here. When we come back, more from Dr. Thomas Harding, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing. Do you think animal testing should be banned in industry where it's not medically necessary, like cosmetics? We'll talk about that when we come back, but you can be part of the conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Kast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Kast. My guest today is Dr. Thomas Harding, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing. He is the Bloomberg School of Public Health's Dornkamp Zbinden Endowed Chair in Evidence-Based Toxicology. We're talking about how technology could one day reduce the number of animals used in research. Do you think that's an important goal? Is it something you'd like to see happen? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. How does the United States compare to the rest of the developed world in terms of animal testing?
I mean, animal testing is done where there is research and where there is economy. And obviously in both, the US is strong, certainly one of the strongest sign system. And the animal use here is about 17 million animals. Europe, in comparison...
17 million a year?
A year, yes.
Are tested?
Are tested.
And most of those are rats and mice?
About 80%. But we're also talking about monkeys, dogs, cats, rabbits, guinea pigs. So half of the zoo is being used. Europe, in comparison, uses 12 million animals with about almost twice the population. So you see that that the U.S. is very intense in its animal use because of strong research.
And the attitudes and the search for alternatives, is that more true here than in Europe?
Yeah, let's say this is changing. The attitude is clearly acceptance rates are much lower in Europe, so people don't like animal experiments. And Europe has also gone ahead, for example, and banned animal testing for cosmetics already in 2003.
2003?
Yes, a dramatic impact on this industry, which is a global industry. Yeah, so it's the same company selling your lipsticks in all over the world. And this is they are really the forerunner. But over the last few years, we have seen that there's a strong interest driven by the agencies here in the US, FDA, EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Food and Drug Administration. They are with very strong programs, put a lot of money into renovating the toolboxes.
And I don't know what you mean by renovating the toolboxes.
I mean, we need tools as a scientist. Mm-hmm. The tests, which were so far mainly animal tests, a certain repertoire, a test to test for cancer, a test to test for effects on the embryo, one for testing on the eye. And for the eye, we use a rabbit. And these are the tools. The tools we have, and they have not been really changed for many years. But seeing that there's tens of thousands of substances for which we have no data, the EPA started big programs, which they call ToxCast or Tox21 for the 21st century. So these programs are trying to develop the new technologies which allow us at reasonable cost to get information on many substances.
And yet when federal agencies fund research, they don't put any limitations on animal testing, do they? They don't say, or they don't give preference to researchers who promise not to use animals.
Let's say we have a societal compromise, which means that whenever it is possible to avoid the experiment, you're obliged to do so. This is how this is executed differs, but you can argue that in many instances there would be an alternative available or there's not, so there's a gray zone, but the principle stands. And while there is a large part of animal research being funded, the very same NIH and others fund also the development of the cellular systems like ours to produce on the long term alternatives to this.
And a regulatory agency like the Food and Drug Administration accepts those kinds of findings as reliable or more so than animal testing, testings from animal testing?
No, we're not yet there. But at the moment, it is a mix. And in this mix, the proportions start changing. So with the companies using more and more non-animal test methods in order to produce their data to develop their drugs, they submit these type of data. And the agencies are seeing more of these data, and they on themselves build capacity to run these type of studies, to understand what they can deliver. So we're talking actively with the FDA about our brain model and others to how this can help them to understand how they can generate data which are meaningful for their decision taking.
We have a call from Raj in Baltimore. Raj, welcome to Midday.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I look at animal testing from a system biology approach, and so let's say we test a drug on this isolated brain model, and the downstream behavior consequences or the way the drug is perceived by the system would be completely different from an isolated system. So the bottom line to me is animal research, as it stands now, cannot be broadly applied to, cannot be negated completely and it's pretty much inevitable to have a complete picture. I'll take my answer off air.
Raj, I appreciate the question. Thank you for calling. What would you tell Raj?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with him. At the moment, we depend on the mix of methodologies. To develop one drug does cost $1.4 billion. That's how much money a pharmaceutical company spends before they have one thing on the market and hope to make the big sales. Yeah. Large part of this is in phases for clinical studies, but before the animal studies and before this, the cell cultures and other methodologies. And by making this latter one more meaningful, we can reduce the part of animals and come quicker to the human studies, which in the end are the ones which are telling us whether a drug does work or does not work. So we are helping to make the part of animal studies less important for drug discovery.
So do you anticipate a time when animal testing would not be needed at all?
I don't think so, because, for example, we are looking for drugs for animals. So this is obviously an animal experiment. There's also aspects like behavioral aspects where it's very difficult to imagine how you would study this without an organism.
Give me an example of that kind of question. When you say behavioral aspects, what?
If you want to study mood disorders, for example, you need something which has a mood,
and this and is obviously not your little ball of cells does not have moods.
I would not claim this, but there's, for example, some genetic risk factors, certain channels of the nerve cells, which play a role in psychiatric disorders. And you could very well imagine that if you are looking for something very selective, which is helping to address this defect, you can help finding a drug. But in the end, you have to test it in an organism which can show behavior.
You mentioned that Europe banned use of animal testing for cosmetics, or they banned the sale of cosmetics that had been tested on animals 13 years ago already. What kind of impact has that had both in Europe, and is there a spillover effect in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about global industries beside many, many small ones, but we know the big ones, the Procter & Gamble's on the U.S. side, or the Unilever's, Johnson & Johnson's, and L'Oreal's, just to mention a few. And quite telling, all of these companies are supporting our work because they are reacting not only to legislation but also to strong consumer wishes. The success of companies like Body Shop, now part of L'Oreal, which have very aggressively branded "We are not testing on animals" all over the world, has really made a difference. And this industry has become an engine of change. A lot of the things which happened over the last 10, 15 years was because they put money behind alternative methods.
And so that's in cosmetics, and you're seeing then an effect from that in other kinds of research?
Yeah, and now the other areas are benefiting. So industrial chemicals, that's an area where much less investment into alternatives took place, but they're very happy now that they can, with the research sponsored by the cosmetic industry originally, can start using these alternative approaches as well.
Well, here in the United States, if I pick up a bottle of shampoo, say, in a store, and the label does not say that it's cruelty-free, should I assume that means it probably was tested on animals?
That's a difficult one, because a lot of these substances are actually completely harmless. A lot of the substances in cosmetic products are actually food ingredients. And since many of the companies are selling worldwide, they have to comply also with the European legislation. They have to produce these things, in the end, animal-free. And they also very often rely on chemicals which have been tested decades ago. So the chemical industry sells to them chemicals which have once been tested in rats or rabbits. So it would be not fair to say that these are animal-free. But they have been historically tested, not recently, as a final product for any consumer uses.
It strikes me that cosmetics is perhaps a different case than some other research because, I mean, ultimately, use of cosmetics is is discretionary. For the most part, we don't need to. And so does that change the way a decision is made about what would be acceptable in testing for cosmetics?
This was certainly a part, but it's also, I think, the strong pressure of animal welfare groups on the cosmetic industry. They've chosen this as a victim because our, let's say, beauty is simply bad justification for doing something bad to animals. And I would argue it's not necessarily the best victim of in this campaign, because we are talking first of all about a small number of animals anyway. Cosmetic industry in Europe, we have good data, before the ban used 0.03% of all animals, so tiny amounts. And these are substances which you actually put into your eye, into your mouth, into your on your skin. So you're exposed, different to industrial chemicals or other household products where you only accidentally have any contact. So I would not have scientifically chosen them. They were the wrong victim, but I always say I'm happy that we had them, because this brought millions of research money into alternatives and some of the big successes.
Hmm. We got an email from Carrie, and I'm going to read part of it and then sort of ask you what it is like to be a scientist at work in this field. Carrie writes, "It is unconscionable that testing has ever been done on animals, no matter the benefits of doing so. The ends do not justify the means, and means of animal testing are monstrous. Just because animals have no voice and can't defend themselves does not somehow make it okay. If anything, it makes it more sick and unethical. It's tantamount to testing on mute orphan children, unless you're a specialist who somehow thinks human pain is more significant unless you are a speciesist who somehow thinks human pain is more significant than non-human sentient animal pain. They are equally significant. I can't believe religious people or any person of conscience could agree with this. Thank goodness we're moving away from the morally destitute practice of animal testing." This is obviously a very fraught field. What is it like? We have I'm giving you just a couple of minutes here, but tell me what it is like to be a scientist working in this area. I mean, do you feel a lot of pressure? Do you feel a lot of support?
I mean, we try to be in the middle ground. This is always difficult. On the one hand, we are scientists and we understand why certain tools have been used. Our world is a safer place because of some animal experiments. But at the same time, I feel the passion and I feel with this. And we should minimize this as fast as possible and to the absolute minimum. And this is not what we're always doing. That's why our center, I think, has an important role to play. We are accelerating the progress towards getting rid of animals. And this is something for 35 years now here in Baltimore, a unique institution, which there's no other of this kind in the U.S. Yeah.
So last month was kind of a milestone with the publication of your research on this mini brain. What's the next step? What are you focusing on right now?
I mean, we want to make this available. And this means does not mean to share our recipes, which we do anyway. We are happy to train people to produce their own mini brains because we want to see this in use. But it would take you, as a specialist, more than a year to build your own mini brains. So most companies cannot wait like that long. So we're trying to establish now a company here in Baltimore which is producing the mini brains, and you can then mail order. Next week I need 100 healthy brains and 100 from a Parkinson patient, and we'll send them. That's the vision we are having, so that nobody has an excuse still to run the animal experiment just because it's simpler to get a rat than a mini brain.
I really appreciate you taking this hour to talk with us about it. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Thanks. Thomas Harding is director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing. He's also one of the inventors of the mini brain, a new technology aimed at replacing drug testing on lab animals in neurology labs. I'd also like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And I want to thank you for listening. On Monday, when do you shop online and when do you shop in person? What drives that decision? We're going to talk about shopping trends. I'm Sheila Cast. It's going to be a bit cooler over the next few days, but it's still spring. Have a great weekend.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.